Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Monday, I guess around midday, and I'm going to continue what I was talking about last week about Herzl and the rise of Zionism, especially now with all the anti-Zionist campaigns going on in, you know, the college campuses and all this other stuff and around the world. I'm not talking about Satmar now. I'm talking about the non-Jewish ones, which has a different nature. And I was mentioning last week how it was precisely reaction to this sort of business that triggered the rise of what we call today's Zionist movement, which I want to speak about now. This is being sponsored by several. First of all, I want to thank Barry Goldberg. I don't know all the people who are doing it, but I'm going to thank them. Barry Goldberg, Miriam Dumby, and Linda Saffer, who I know very well, in memory of her husband, who I knew very, very, very well, Jerry Saffer, who is sorely missed. I've spoken about him in the past. We were very close friends. He was a very quality type of guy. Well-known. He found his own way to observance, did himself, and he was a leading child psychologist. We need quality shrinks these days. The question is, where do you find them? HaChochma me'ayin timotze. He was a very wise person. He had a lot of wise things, which I guess is a result, if you're in the psychology business and you know what you're doing, I emphasize, and you know what you're doing, then there's a big deal of chokhmah involved in this. And, you know, he wrote a book not long before he passed away from an illness called Wednesday Evenings and Every Other Weekend. You can look it up if you want to. Probably cost a buck. Him and Dr. McClure in Virginia. Dan McClure, also a very wonderful person. Dan McClure. And it's, you know, let's put it this way. It's for children in divorce. I mean, if you're a child psychologist, chances are a lot of what you're seeing is broken families, correct? I mean, who's the carbonist when there's a divorce? I'm not saying divorce is not justified. It is, you know, in the right situation. But they're carbonists, all right? And the kids, of course, are the main carbon. Well, I can't generalize, but I'm going to generalize anyway, even though I shouldn't. And that's why his book was called Wednesday Evenings and Every Other Weekend, you know, to give out what he called the custody and all that business. You see a lot of chachma, you know, down there is chachma. So anyway, the yard site is coming up, I think, the end of this week. And so Linda and the others, the Goldbergs and Dumbies, are sponsoring this. I want to thank everybody. And let me pick up best as I can where we left off last time, because I think it's very new. Okay, of course, tomorrow is Israel Independence Day and so on and so forth. I thought it's today, you know. I mean, I'm not a big Zionist or anything. I thought, hey, you, but it turns out, because it was Saturday night, it was Yom HaZikaron or something like that, they moved everything up. It's a Nidre, you know what I'm saying? It's a Nidre. I did not know that. But anyway, but it's very appropriate over here. Moshe Levy from Israel sent me a photo, I guess from where he lives, where there's this big sign for the B'nai Akiva Yeshivas of Lezecher Nishmas. I'm sorry to say this, a ton of guys killed in the war. You know what I mean? It's like a big yard site plaque with a lot of names on it. I mean, it's pretty whatever, sobering. I'm talking about this war now. So we know that there have been plenty of Karbonas Pshuta Kamashmo in this war. And it ain't over yet. We can only hope and pray. I'm not going to get up into a tangent on what's going on with Biden and Israel and the Hamas and all this stuff now. But I'm rather going back into history. 120 years ago, 130 years ago, that's when Herzl popped up. And create a movement, the fact you create a movement is the significant part. And so I think last time I brought up the story till the 1890s, he was born 1860. So here's the guy in his 30s. And although he had nothing to do with Judaism, but he wasn't unaware of it, and he didn't deny his Jewish identity, they say at one point he thought of converting. Big deal. Everybody thought of that at that time. You know, if you didn't come from a firm background, I can't tell you how many people say, oh, life would be great if I was a guy. You know, that's just the way it went. But he didn't. The anchor point is he didn't. And I'm sorry to say this. I'm sure there's plenty of American Jews right now who say, oh, if I wasn't Jewish, oh, it'd be great. It's sad. But it's a Matthias. Okay? It's a Matthias. So here you have this guy who was educated. Oops, one second. Who was educated. And he was a famous writer, journalist. So that's significant. Journalists, newspaper people, first of all, can write quickly and well. And second of all, they're up on current events, meaning they're interested in the world going around you. The average guy out there is not necessarily interested in the world going around you, right? You got your life to live. You got your business to run. You got your family issues. And nothing wrong with that at all. Halavai, a person should have he or she should have a quiet life. And the only thing they should worry about is the next bar mitzvah in the family, you know. The tension should be the Jane Austen tensions of Shidduchim and whatever. Fine. I get that. But some people think beyond that. Some people are what we call today news junkies. Okay? And so, that's the type he was. To his credit, in spite of the fact he lived a completely non-observant lifestyle, had Christmas trees and all the rest of it, they did. But he thought about the fact that Jews are under attack everywhere. But remember, I told you last time, he lived in a funny environment in Europe where the Jews legally did have the rights. By 1870, they had gotten all civil rights outside of Russia. But it was accompanied by a lot of resentment of that and a pushback. And sometimes it was a fear. I mean, I would say all times a fear. Maybe this will make the volcano explode. The government will say, what a terrible mistake we made about the Jews. Let's go and either reverse it or kill them or something like that. Which, I tell you again, you and I know, sadly speaking, did happen with Hitler and all the rest of it. I mean, Hitler didn't come out of nowhere, right? I mean, he hedged it up. He fanned the flames of discontent. But it's not like he created the whole thing in the first place. He took advantage of an existing anti-Semitism. He just took it in an organized way, as we all know, to terrible results. I mean, that's what he did. So, thoughtful Jews were thinking along these lines, although the regular liberal Jews tell you, oh, don't be so pessimistic. And second of all, it's politically incorrect to be gyrus these people who are anti-Semitic, because then you give some kind of legitimacy to what they say. You have to, as much as possible, you know, operate as if they weren't there. And we have, as we would say today, ADL type of organizations to fight this. They were very ineffective. They had one in Germany, the Zentralverein. They worked entirely within the system. Anyway, things were not great. On the other hand, when an individual, so my point's like this. For Klal Yisrael, things are not great. For individual Yisrael, everybody makes his own bed. This guy could be successful in business, the other guy not. This guy might have a career as a doctor, the other guy not. You know what I'm saying? In other words, even in the old America, we had quotas. On an individual level, you could figure some way. I mean, maybe. You could figure some way around the quota. Can't get into Harvard, you get into the University of Wisconsin. You know? Medical school in Montana. I mean, it gets the chaneitza. But as a broad group, the Jews were not socially desirable. And, of course, in the middle of the 1890s came the Dreyfus Affair, where a French officer who was Jewish was framed as being a traitor to France. And it was a whole frame business. There are movies about it, books. And the key point is, when he was publicly when this guy, Captain Dreyfus, was publicly found guilty and exiled to an island where he's supposed to die on the island because of such a bad weather. The public was ecstatic. That's the significance from the Jewish point of view of the Dreyfus affair. You know what I'm saying? It's not that there was a plot by the French officers and general staff to screw a Jewish officer. That is true, right? That's true. That did happen. But the social ripple, where mobs ran through the street and said, kill the Jews and down with the Jews and this, that, and the other. I mean, chas v'chalil, imagine, we've seen a tiny drop of that in the current business with these demonstrations against Israel. What if big mobs ran around, literally saying, b'peh moleh, you know, kill the Jews? It's easy for me to sit here on a podcast and just talk about something happened long ago. If you lived that time, freak you out. Now, the French Jews, like the American Jews, it's like this. We're putting our trust in the French institutions, the government, the police, this is, you know, the people in charge, the army will not let the pogroms happen. And there's truth to that. Okay? So it never got out. I mean, maybe they broke a few windows here and there. It never got out into a, like we say, mamash pogrom. But they were scared out of their minds. And what they did was more an example of being passive, but arguing that passive is the right way to go. I don't know what you call that. You know what I'm saying? A lot of times people say, I guess, what do you do in this situation? Don't do anything. It's not shot that they thought it through and they came up with don't do anything. You're naturally, you know, a passive and lazy person, have no courage, whatever. Therefore, you turn your natural fear thing into a philosophy. You see? Jews are very good at doing that. They're doing good at doing that now, I'm sorry to say. Now, in the course of all this, was his experience in Vienna, now his experience in Paris, and he's looking around, and if you read the Jewish papers, they used to call attention to the fact that here and here and here and here and here, all over the place in different Europe, there's one anti-Semitic incident after another, and those are the more prominent ones. The dissing of the Jews in social context was even much more widespread. So you can either say, look, you know, there are bad people out there, but I don't have to live my life around them. Or you can say, listen, buddy, Europe is problematic. You know what I'm saying? This is not going the way we thought. We see there's a hole in the liberal thesis that if the Jews are given equal citizenship, that'll lead to their complete blending in society and will eliminate anti-Semitism. What I just said was politically profoundly incorrect in those days. To say that even though you have civil rights, the Jews will not be accepted, and it will lead to bitter feelings. You're not supposed to say that, you see? But Herzl was an interesting guy. He left these diaries and all the rest of it. He was, in simple terms, a person with chutzpah and gaiva, which is not necessarily a bad thing, depends how you use it. He wasn't a mechutzef. That's who he was. Because he obviously felt he should be a great man and nothing is happening. Why doesn't the world see he's a great man? And it was about gaiva also because, as I said before, he held that he saw things other people didn't see. He has a better vision than them. He understands and sees better than the others. No one will take him seriously. He used to write this in the diaries. Now, ordinarily, in social company, you don't like somebody who's a balgaiva, who's arrogant. You like somebody who's a chutzpahnik. I get that. That's for regular, middle-class, bourgeois company. I don't want such a person at my Shabbos table either. On the other hand, there's a time and place for everything. And if it's channeled the right way, maybe it'll lead to something big. That's what happened. This is me talking. This is my interpretation. The thing about him is, he came up with the idea that he said like this. The cause of anti-Semitism is us. It's also the bad guys. He's not justifying the bad guys. But I can understand. You can view Jews as obnoxious and so forth and so on. As he said, we carry anti-Semitism wherever we go in our baggage. I know what he means. And therefore, the question is, what do you do about it? And since Europe at that time was a civilized place, at least at the government level, right? At the government level, so at the societal level, the Jews were given citizenship by the ruling class, by the kings and the governments in Germany and Austria-Hungary and in France and Italy and the other places. It did happen. So the question then becomes like this. Listen, you got a problem on the hand, which is your local Jews. What's the solution in a civilized way? What's the solution? It's like people going and saying, we got a bad element in our neighborhood. I don't want these guys here. But I'm not saying I'm going to kill and burn their house down. What do we do about it? Right? What do we do about it? Now, some will say, one person will say, I guess, how can you even talk like that? That's so racist. And so on. And that was the liberal view. And I understand and I respect that. Herzl said, cut the bull. That's his whole thesis. Cut the bull. It is what it is. It's Metzius. And so I'm saying to my fellow Jews, recognize this and let's start to do the following. Let's ask ourselves for an actual plan how to fix it. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work, but it's better than having no plan. You understand? What's the plan to fix it? He said, I have my ideas. If you have ideas, tell me your ideas, fine. But to have no ideas and just say, wait it out, and gamze yavor, it's not a plan. Like I said before, that's being lazy and just dignifying laziness with the status of a sheet of a philosophy, right? What's the plan, he said. And as you know, I assume you know, his idea was, we have to make a Jewish state somewhere, right? Get our own country. By definition, if we have a Jewish country where the majority is Jewish, if not everybody, can't be any anti-Semitism. And so if you're a young guy, you want to become a doctor, there can't be an anti-Semitic quota in a Jewish country. You'll get into medical school. And you'll practice based on your merits. And same thing with every profession and every business. Whatever will happen, it won't be discrimination against Jews because they're Jewish. That's a tautology. I mean, it's obviously true. If the state is Jewish, if the country is Jewish and composed of Jews, they'll have their own mishigas. Every country in the world has mishigas. Every country in the world has political divisions and economic and social divisions. Boy, in the 1890s, all the countries were riven with these kinds of divisions, especially economic divisions, the haves and the have-nots. But it won't be because you're Jewish. So it won't be a situation where a guy goes to college, gets a degree, is a very competent situation, but they won't hire him, get a job, because he's a Jew. Right? That's actually a very straightforward and simplistic idea. Easier said than done. In the beginning, Herzl thought he came with a gewaltige chat. Nobody had thought this before, which wasn't exactly true. And he, being a modern guy and a secular guy and all the rest of it, did not have in mind, we're going to go back to Malchus Beis David thousands of years ago, rebuild the base and make all the rest of it. A modern country like any other country, like in Europe, European country, Western country. The Jews have been in Europe for a long time. Lately, they picked up the European civilization, meaning the technological knowledge and all the rest of it, which was a plus. Let's build a modern country. So let's make a state of Israel. I mean, he didn't use those words, but let's make a state of Israel somewhere. And it'll be the equivalent of Italy and France and Spain and Switzerland and so on and so forth. How do you make that happen? It's easy. In other words, some solutions are simple, but they're not so simple. How do you make it happen? So at that time, his first thought was that, and I'll say again, he wasn't the most practical guy in the world, but the other, he wasn't the most impractical guy either. And he basically came up like this, thinking it through. A country needs, you have to have land, plus you have to have people. How do you build up the land to people?
Let's go to the millionaires, like the Rothschilds and all that, the billionaires. And they had the equivalent of billionaires at that time. The amount of money you're talking about was, like today, billions. And he had a fair number of those. And let me get them in a room and tell them, look, to solve the problems of anti-Semitism, which you also want to solve, Rothschild, right? Let's buy a country. Let's go to somewhere, let's say Israel. I mean, he thought it'd be Eretz Yisrael, but it didn't have to be. And just buy it, because your money's endless. It was. The money was endless. And automatically we'll have a piece of land that we own, a big area, size of a country. And then, to have an instant Jewish population, I'll go to these Hasidic Rebbes, and they have millions of followers in aggregate. They certainly got a million or two. So if I pull in the Ger, I mean, you know, the Sadi Ger Rebbe, the Ger Rebbe, whoever was the big Rebbes at that time, he knew about Sadi Ger. And let's say like this. The Hasidic movement, remember, he's a secular guy. The Hasidic movement, by definition, as Simon says, the Rebbe tells you to do, you do it. So tell all your followers to move there to Israel, which is not something that's anti-Hasidic, anti-from, the opposite, right? What's wrong with moving there to Israel? Hasidus, all from Jews, long at one level or another for Eretz Yisrael. Why is it a mitzvah to live in Galicia? So just tell them all to go. And presto digito, you got yourself a Jewish state. Now, I realize they'll all be Hasidic, all the rest of it. But he figured once you get the state going, then we'll bring the other Jews, the secular ones, over because they want to move there. And it won't be Hasidic. It'll be a regular country. The secular Jews coming over will be the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers, the people who know how to do stuff. Not like the Hasidim as he saw it. And 1, 2, 3, you made yourself a cake. You got yourself a country. And it's ice anti-Semitism. Why? Because the problem is there are too many Jews living in Europe. Here the Jews, or many of them, will move. He was convinced of this. Why would somebody want to stay in a country that doesn't like him? Move to Eretz Yisrael, for example. If it's legal and it's fine, and it's your own country. Tzivishin zich. Right? You want to live among Jews. This is his basic idea. Now, by the way, let's just pretend this would have happened. Right? What I mean to say is like this. Rothschild had immense money. And if you put Rothschild together with another 10 billionaires, you're talking about a gigantic amount of money. Suppose, let's just pretend. In 1895, these guys, who were at the height of their financial power, if you know the history of these Jewish financiers, 1890s in the fin de siècle, in France, England, Germany, Austria, they were at the height of their financial power. If they were to concentrate all their money and sell like this, we're giving away all a vast fortune. Look, I'm going to tell you something. Rothschild could give away a billion or two and still have plenty left. He's still not going to starve. You understand? And certainly in the aggregate, right? I'm using current numbers. So, let's, again, I'll just make a case up. Let's say they found an island somewhere, and they bought the island. You know, let's say Cyprus, I mean, I don't know, whatever. And they said, now we own it, you know, legally. And then the Hasidim all come in huge numbers. So all of a sudden you have a million people. That's the majority of the population. You have a Jewish state. Boy, that means the Jews in Europe would have ducked those terrible years of the first half of the 20th century. They would have ducked World War I and World War II and Hitler and all the rest of it. Just imagine that, right? But we would have been spared because the worst years ever in Jewish history, as you and I know, were the first 45 years of the 20th century. There never was a period as bad as that. There never was a period when so many were killed and tortured and this and the other. We use the number 6 million, which is basically a more or less accurate number if you mean World War I and World War II and the Ukrainian massacres, all the rest of it.
The Hitler thing is, I always understand something like, I always say five and a half. Right? But if you throw in the other, you're talking about 6 million. 6 million nefashas. Give me a break. 6 million neshamas. Right? And more. Instead, where would the Jews be in the world? I'm just, like I said, just fantasizing. He said, where would the Jews be today? They would have, you know, 10, 20 million somewhere. You understand? But of course it didn't happen, because it's easier said than done. It's easier for me to go to you, a rich guy, and say, I'm going to tell you how to spend your money. And then the other way around. My father used to say, how's it go? The guy went to Rothschild, I think. And he says, Nitak and Yashan, there's no justice. The rich people have the money, poor people don't have none. The poor people are the ones that need the money. So, therefore, the rich people should give the money to the poor people. So Rothschild, according to the story, Rothschild says to the beggar, so there's so-and-so many million Jews in the world, and so on and so forth. If you divide it up, how much does each guy get? Let's say, for example, 10 bucks. Here's your 10 bucks and go to the devil. You understand? In other words, don't bother me. It's easy for somebody to tell somebody else how to spend the money. That doesn't mean it's not a smart idea. It's just a tremendous failure of the imagination. Same thing with the Hasidic Rebbe's. Who the heck is this joker? He just came with the idea by should move to Israel or wherever, you know, and we should set up his kind of state. He's not even, he doesn't even know what Yiddishkeit is. I don't think Herzl could even speak Yiddish. Spoke German. And so that shidduch did not happen. Okay? That shidduch did not happen. And he was very frustrated by this, because you can tell from the diaries, you know, he said, don't these people see? And so on and so forth. Now, he convinced himself in order to make the, I tell you, you got to have, be a balgaiva, you have to have a chutzpah. And gaiva means you have to have a certain arrogance. You don't let facts get in the way. He convinced himself that it would be possible to get a country in Israel, because at that time, the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which ruled the Middle East, was in such bad financial shape that if you offer them the right deal, you know, they'll take it. It's somewhere along the lines now. It's not exactly the same thing, but somewhere along the lines now. Suppose somebody said today, America, I'll tell you what, you're $35 trillion in the hole, which is an enormous amount you'll never get out of. What if I can put together a consortium and pay you $35 trillion, but I want Hawaii? Huh? I want Hawaii or Oahu or something like that. You know? What would happen if that ever popped up? Yeah? $35 trillion. That's an unbelievable amount. And all of a sudden, America would not have any deficit. All of a sudden, we could pay our bills. All of a sudden, all the social programs could be funded and so forth and so forth. And we'd have an economy a million times healthier. You understand the, I don't have to tell you, you understand the advantages. Because this debt is going to bury us. So I know how you get out of it. Right? Unless, like I always say, unless you elect Trump and he declares Chapter 11, because he's a bucky in bankruptcy. You know, how you going to get out of it? So if I come, I mean, I think Biden would be dreaming about this. You know, let me put it this way. If somebody went to Biden and says, I can come up with $35 trillion to pay you as a gift, the USA, you'll have no more debts. He'd have a certain cognitive dissonance. On the other hand, you don't want to give up territory, right? And Hawaii is valuable. And it was part of America. You know, I get that with all the patriotic impulses that go along with that. And I do understand that. On the other hand, boy, no debt. Balanced budget. It's too much. How could that ever be? You know what I'm saying? Like, what a paradise we would have from an economic point of view. course, we could start on running up another $35 trillion debt. But meanwhile, you'd be living the life of Riley. And so, Herzl, so who knows what would happen? I just gave you a good theme for like a short story or a novel, right? Somebody comes and offers, you know, we want Alaska, we want Hawaii, we want Florida, I don't know, whatever, you know, want Miami, pay $35 trillion. So Herzl basically thought in these terms. Again, you have to be pretty much a tremendously self-assured, arrogant person to think in these terms. But he said, he convinced himself, Turkish Empire is in bad shape. They got a debt that they'll never be able to solve, which is true. Let us buy Eretz Yisrael. We could even have, you know, a Jewish self-governing state within the framework of the Turkish Empire, as long as we are the bosses within our own country. And the Turks will say yes. Now, Lemaisa, when push came to shove, didn't work out that way. He came up with these ideas around 1894, 1895. He died a decade later. He went to Turkey a number of times. He actually spoke to the Sultan. And they say, no way. Because, like I said before, it's a matter of patriotism and pride. It's a matter of Islam. I had a student in college once, a Turkish guy. And he said, he was telling me, it's a famous in Turkey that, you know, the Sultan told Herzl no. And, you know, any country you don't die for is not a real country. And, you know, you can't buy it. Words to that effect. But he would not be convinced that this is not a feasible program. And the reason he wasn't convinced is because his whole idea falls apart if you don't persuade yourself it's doable. So you have to have, as I said, a certain arrogance, a certain chutzpah, and a certain willfulness in which I know I'm right. I'm not going to let the facts get in the way. Ordinarily, it sounds cynical, but people with big dreams and visions think like that. You know, I'm not going to allow mundane facts to get in the way. Somehow or other, we'll make it work. This was his yisod. Now, you and I know it didn't work out, meaning the Muslims never did agree to sell anything. Not a whole country, anyway. But I'm talking about how he envisioned it. Now, you could be, you know, cynical and say it's a Jewish attitude, you know, anything's up for sale. But the truth of the matter is, not everything's up for sale. I wish it were, but what? Not everything up for sale. That's why you got a war going on right now in the Middle East. Right? There's the heart of it. Now, one more point before I close down for today. He did not see this as something sneaky or underhanded. The person I'm talking about had more to do with people who are not Jewish than most Jews. His business and his profession put him in contact all the time as a leading journalist with movers and shakers in the Goyish societies in France, in Austria, and these kind of places. He knew these type of people. He didn't walk into some government office and say, oh, I'm a Jewish guy. I got to mind my P's and Q's. He knew their foibles, their weaknesses, their strengths, all the rest of it. So as a Jew, he had unusual knowledge of people not Jewish, much more than most Jews. This is interesting. So I would say he was an expertise in the European mentality, specifically the elite European mentalities of his day. His day was the 1890s. And at that time, Europe was at a peak of strength that it never has had since. Okay? Europe in the 1890s, like, really rocked. Just Google a map of the world around 1900 or so, in the early 1900s, and you see European countries, as an aggregate, ruled almost the entire world. If you're talking about the British Empire and the French Empire alone, like I say, just for the heck of it, Google the British Empire in 1900, 1920 is even better. You see, they own a big portion of the globe, physical portion of the globe. A little island like England? How'd that work? The French also had a vast empire in some ways. They always were jealous of the British. And without going into the details, they built up their own empire. A big chunk of Africa. Google Africa, in 1920 or 1910 or whatever. You see how much huge of it is owned by France. So just between England and France, they owned a major portion of the globe. Physically owned it. It's called imperialism and colonialism. If you add in a couple other countries, especially Germany, Spain, Portugal, Italy eventually got a couple of colonies. And the USA really is like a European country. And America had an empire. As a matter of fact, 1890s is exactly when America acquired the empire. In the middle of the 1890s was McKinley, President McKinley. That's when they annexed Hawaii. And a few years later, the United States of America had a little war with Spain, and they annexed the Philippine Islands and a bunch of other islands in the Pacific. So all of a sudden, America became an imperialist country. As a matter of fact, one of the big fights in American politics in the 1890s, McCall, and afterwards, was specifically over the question of imperialism. I remember, just if you're interested, go online and look up the presidential election of 1900. It was William Jennings Bryan versus McKinley, round two. And Bryan ran on an anti-imperialist platform. There's certainly an argument for that. Okay? The Republicans won, so the country went imperialist. We crushed the whole uprising pretty ruthlessly in the Philippines. There's a whole long story to that. Plus, we also took over Puerto Rico, annexed it to the country, still part of America. They could have annexed Cuba. They didn't do that. Turns out that was a mistake, because later on, the communists took over. America was part of the imperialism business, okay? And the reason I'm mentioning this is because, man, think about Russia. Russia didn't have overseas colonies. Russia just gobbled up everything in their shkenim, in their neighbors, like they're doing now. And so, it was a much simpler world in the 1890s from that point of view. So if you're Herzl, you want to get the world to go along with the idea of a Jewish state. Which he said, I want to do openly and publicly. You're not really talking to the world. You're not certainly not talking to what we call today the third world, right? You're talking to a half a dozen countries. Obviously, England and France and Germany. By the way, Belgium at the time of Herzl, had conquered the Belgian Congo, which is gigantic, and they were unbelievably cruel. They were like the Nazis, the Belgians, to the black people in Africa. It's a terrible story. They almost made a Holocaust. Go check it out. So, Herzl's idea is like this. England, Germany, Russia, a few other countries, if they get on board with what I'm talking about, then they're able to make it happen. Now, the question is, how does one go about doing that? That, my friends, I'll save for next time. So again, I want to thank the Goldbergs and the Dombies and the Saffers for sponsoring today. And with that, I wish everybody a good week.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.